Hello and welcome again to the Bald Move television show. Bald Move TV, the officially unofficial podcast about all of television. I'm your host, Aaron, and joining me today is...
Cecily.
And we're going to be talking about a lot of stuff today. American Gods, Handmaid's Tale, and Dear White People. You know, I'd just like to thank that nice young black woman for writing me a missive.
What?
We're the white people that she's talking to.
Oh.
And
I thought you were talking about the show creator.
Actually, he is a black man.
He is a black man.
I listened to a lengthy interview with him on Andy and Chris's show on The Ringer.
We just want to talk about that show up front?
I wasn't going to, but damn it, you're forcing my hand. Dear White People. So this is super controversial, incredibly, because white people have a hard time listening to black people talk about their authentic experiences in life.
You know what? Why isn't there a White History Month?
You know, I've thought that every single time we have a Black History Month.
Yep.
Like, why? Why don't we teach white history in America? It's crazy. It's crazy because there's so much of it.
There's so much of it. Like, I open up a history book and it's just full of, like, black history, Native American culture, you know, the English and the French. It's just... But not enough white America in my culture.
99% of what I was taught was white history, and it just seems a shame that we just have Black History Month when there's all that right. white history on the table. So the deal is, I think it's interesting because if you look on Netflix, this has got like a 2.5-star rating.
Does it?
Similarly to Amy Schumer's new Netflix special, which is sitting atop a lofty 1-star rating.
Is it really?
Oh yeah. Like the people are just not liking the politics or not liking the views espoused and are downvoting properly. And it's funny because I saw the statement the showrunner made and's like, he's not mad about like the backlash or the boycott. He says it just kind of proves the point that you know that and I understand like why it's uncomfortable. Like if you believe in like a post-racial America and you come in and you tune into this television show, it's got to be like a slap in the face. It's essentially like going into marriage counseling with what you think is, you know, it's a happy marriage, but, you know, maybe there's a tweak here and there. And then you listen to your mate talk for a half hour about just how desperately unhappy and how angry they are about how unfair the situation is. And you just can't fucking believe it.
And you never come back to counseling because you just aren't prepared to hear those things.
You can't fucking believe how just ungrateful and wrongheaded and whiny it all is.
Right. Yes.
So, I mean, I don't know what to say because this, it's interesting because I found myself like, you just have to kind of let this wash over you. And there's a lot of this stuff that I watch because... and there's been a lot of this, like Atlanta and Insecure
right.
touches on a lot of issues that even I'm not like it's something that's like in the black community, like the way their attitudes towards homosexuality.
It's almost as if all kinds of different people have all kinds of different experiences.
And that's the other thing is that they touch on the fact that you've got like these kind of, you know, I'm not sure they'd identify as Republicans, but like the black Republicans, they're from the wealthier families. And
yeah.
And the fact that like if you like privilege isn't like a binary concept. Like, you know, if you're a white person and you have that white privilege, that doesn't mean that life is an easy street for you. And it doesn't mean that just because you're black means that you have every set of stereotypical disprivileges that people might be able to name. It's like it's a spectrum.
Right.
And like, you know, there's also male and female. There's gay and straight. There's gender identity. There's political identity. There's social and economic status. There's physical attractiveness.
Right.
Which all these people are crazy good looking.
They're insanely good looking.
I've gotten used to like, oh, here's Anne Hathaway and she's got dumpy clothes on and she's got thick framed glasses and she's not wearing hardly any makeup, or at least she's reading as ugly so she can be transformed to princess. But I was stunned this Lionel kid when he got a haircut.
Got his first good haircut
because he finally found the barber who wasn't going to shame him for being a homosexual.
He's
stunning. He's so good looking.
Yeah,
it's like Steve Urkel turning into Stefan Urkel. It's like holy shit.
Right. And what's he gonna do after college? Who's he going to go to cut his hair? Is he just going to come back to Troy forever?
I don't know. Maybe he'll go to a salon.
Do you think there's a will they, won't they kind of thing?
No. Man,
oh, I'm
Troy...
joking. Okay. Okay. But Troy, he seems to, you know, Troy have loves... all kinds of taste. I think that, you know, for his episode that we got to focus on him on, he is sleeping with everyone, all the women that you would expect him to.
Right.
Then he has a relationship with a lesbian teacher. Uh-huh. Or bisexual, I guess, is what
An older lesbian.
Right.
Some sort of professor. I'm not sure what she studied.
Black history.
What? Or, is it really?
African-American studies, rather.
Okay. All right.
Black history.
Does it last a day? It's like, yes. a tenth of a credit for that.
What do you call her? What do you call it? Celebrity lecturer. Not celebrity,
right.
But... I don't know either.
She just
lectures through the month of February.
Oh, I got you.
She's a guest lecturer. Yeah.
But it starts off with this... It's an interesting premise because it starts off with this character, Sam, who has a controversial radio show on campus called Dear White People,
mm-hmm.
where she essentially kind of lectures the white kids on campus about how they are, you know, even though they're in an elite school that might think that they are above concepts such as class and racism, she's telling them that they're not.
Mm-hmm.
And she finds out that at one point in protest of her show, they were the one of the rich white kid frats were planning a blackface.
It's a newspaper.
Oh, it's a newspaper.
One of the college newspapers. Pastiche.
Was planning a blackface party. And cooler heads prevailed. And they're like, you know, they were just, quote unquote, woke enough to realize, oh, we can't do this. But they, you know, it was far enough in the planning stages. They had a flyer going and all that. She got in possession of it and then printed them out. And then the party went on as not planned, I guess.
Yeah.
And you can see all of the reactions to like, well, this was kind of a trap. And then her reaction was, well, if it was a trap, it shouldn't have sprung because what white person in their right mind goes to this party for blackface? And it's so interesting because you and I've had a kind of relevant experience with this because my son formerly went to a school that is 100% white. There are no black kids to be found. There mm-hmm. are no black families to be found in this community. And it was a STEM class, science, technology, engineering, math, like the kids that are like in the top echelons of like, you know, so these are kids yes. that are like smart and fairly well educated and paying attention at school. And they're assigned different historical figures to research and dress like and then give a presentation. And one of the blonde girl about 9 years old got George Washington Carver and showed up in full on blackface.
It was shocking.
Right.
Shocking ignorance that nobody commented on it at all while right. we were walking by.
And I'm amazed at how
teacher,
many...
They did had to have done a dress rehearsal, and the teacher approved this
right.
to go forward.
And I'm amazed at how many people, when I've explained that story, how many white people have looked at me completely confused and like, well, what else was she...
How are you supposed to dress like
George Washington How are you supposed Carver? To... Yeah. Like, the skin tone is the most important thing about embodying that character.
Right.
Not their... Like, you'd be confused if you just saw a blonde girl in a suit and some sort of wig, and she was just explaining the accomplishments, and she has a picture of the man that she's supposed to be right there. Like, right. I don't know. It was crazy. But, you know, I've seen a lot of commentary, this is just manufactured. This would never happen. Like, bullshit. Bullshit right. happens. Like, every year celebrities during Halloween are busted for doing what they think are hilarious black. Like, when Orange and New Black came out, I can't remember who it was, but...
It was Julianne Hough, dressed like Crazy Eyes.
Okay. Yeah. Like, it happens, and it's gross. And if you don't understand why it's gross,
this show is for you.
This show is for you. And also, it's on you to kind of like when someone says this bothers and hurts me, like your job isn't to talk them out of why they're bothered or hurt. Your job
right,
is to
it's
educate.
Not about making your perspective known. It's about getting some other perspective from a different life experience.
Right. And that's the thing is The other unfortunate thing about race relations is when you've got to deal, it's all bound up with the term minority, right? That, you know, you've got this minority experience that, and they live it, right? And but everyone in the majority kind of comes up, brushes up against it, and it's like this unique, exotic thing. Like, oh, that's such a pretty name. Where does it come from? Like, you think you're taking interest.
You look so exotic and beautiful. Where did you get that coloring from?
Exactly.
Which I've seen that a lot more than blackface, and it's just as bad.
And people don't, they think they're being nice or taking an interest, but what you don't understand is for this person, this happens several times a week, perhaps a day.
A day, right.
And it just continually reinforces them that I'm not a real
You're different.
I'm different. I'm not from here. I'm an outsider. And, you know, and our goal to be a melting pot, we shouldn't be doing that. I mean, that's certainly a question. Like, if you're into a stage of relationship with a person where you're a friend and you've had several dinners and you're ready to talk about some beyond the surface things about your backgrounds and families and upbringing, then sure, bring it
right,
up.
Right, it's
then.
A natural part of getting to know someone to ask about their family, parents. I mean, I do it sometimes. I love asking people what their parents look like, but I mean,
sure.
That's not the first thing you ask someone.
It's not something that you'd ask a stranger. It's not something you'd ask someone serving you food or trying to fix your cell phone or walking down the street.
Right.
But there's lots of things like that I think are fascinating. And like the latest episode, well, it's not the latest episode because it's all Netflix. It just came out like a shotgun. We've seen the first three.
Right.
And roughly chapter one is about Sam, the radio show.
So,
And the fact that she's just like, I wouldn't say militant because that might have some.
She's a little bit more radicalized than a lot of the other people. And what do they call their group? It's not the Black Caucus, is it?
Yeah, it's something like that. It's
they
like
have
the
different
Black
like,
student body.
Right. They have different, you know, factions of Black people, including the Black Caucus and
the Black
Republicans. I forget all the names. I didn't go to college.
the birds.
Yeah. So they all have their weekly meeting, and she's a little bit more radicalized, and she kind of set herself up for a downfall because I'm not going to say it's an equal problem, but she just made it clear that it's all about, you know, black culture and inclusion and all
she
of that.
She made a statement about black women dating white men are kind of like race traders.
Right.
And while she's dating a white guy.
Right. So guess what? It's a human experience to just be a hypocrite.
Right. And also like the kind of shoe being on the other foot when this guy goes to hang around her black friends and, you know, he's made to feel very other and different. And she's got
and
a
she
point.
She doesn't help with that either.
And she's got a point with like, oh, well, this is one day out of your life. This is my life every day. And he's also got a point with like, if that might be true, but if we were around my friends and they were behaving that way, it wouldn't have been cool. I would have stood up for you and you kind of right. throw me to the wolves. And that's, I feel like if you make the effort to actually watch the fucking show rather than have a knee-jerk reaction, you'll see that all these concerns that you might bring up are addressed in a far more thoughtful and interesting way than you might first expect off of a kind of knee-jerk reaction.
Right. Glad we solved the world's race problems.
We didn't.
The show itself is interesting because, and I don't know if you like this, but each episode kind of overlaps in a way. Each episode, as far as the first three go, is about one particular character in this group
right.
of friends or acquaintances. And their stories semi-overlap, while it looks like by the third episode we're still moving forward with our mm-hmm. progress. The first three were about
plot-wise,
Sam,
not socially.
Yeah, Sam, Lionel, and Troy. What do you think about that? What do you think about watching the same story over and over?
I think it works. It's all about how skillfully you do it. Like, you know, it's something that I freaking hate in The Walking Dead. It's something that I really celebrate and love about The Leftovers. And I think this show, because the perspectives are so radically different. You know, you've got this gay, nerdy black man. You've got this incredibly good-looking, successful, politically oriented black man who's also wealthy. And then you have a incredibly good-looking a woman from maybe not as privileged socioeconomic status, and she's
there's got to be money for all of them somewhere. They're at Ivy League school.
True, true. Or they're really fucking smart and they got scholarships because you know
right.
that's still there's a little bit of upper mobility.
But I did hear an NPR bit about that a while back that they have a quota to fill of a certain amount of minority groups that they
right.
accept. So.
Right. But you know, I think that because the perspectives are so radically, I guess that's why maybe I just hit upon why The Leftovers and this succeeds where the Walking Dead fails, because The Walking Dead, there's not that variety of perspectives. Everybody is got some form of dramatic PTSD and a very cynical, you know, world-weary, semi-suicidal outlook on life. Sure. And there's no, right. You don't get anything from a deep dive into Morgan's backstory that you wouldn't get in the deep dive from Carol or Daryl or...
Right, but you're right. They did do that on Leftovers this week, too. You got Kevin Jr.'s perspective next, or I guess a couple weeks ago. And then the next episode was Kevin Sr., and you could tell that those stories did overlap right on top of each right. other.
And then Nora, they're sandwiched in the middle. Not on the show, plot-wise.
Yeah, well, her episode came after.
Well, it went Kevin Jr., Nora, Kevin Sr., and then back to, I guess, a blended Kevin-Nora episode.
Right.
Synthesis.
And I think that was done a little bit better, because with these episodes of Dear White People, we're literally recycling a lot of shots to just see... Like, oh, yeah, remember when you saw him here? Here's what he was really thinking at this point. So here, let's show him again.
Right.
But I guess I'm gonna see how the rest of it plays out. But I also think it feels a little bit tedious.
Here's the part, because I know what you're talking about, but also I really enjoyed this part. In the first episode where Lionel's explaining to Sam about how he hacked into the Facebook group and stole this thing, you look at Lionel, and he's got this glasses and this big afro, and he's kind of dressed like a nerd, and you're like, oh, this is this.
Of course that kid's a hacker.
Yeah. And then you find out in an earlier episode that he is not, like, he is a big science fiction nerd, because he's, like, dressed up as Geordi LaForge in a prom and got beat up for it. But he's not that kind of nerd. He's just parroting what he heard from the actual kind of, you know.
Well, that guy wasn't even nerdy.
Right.
He was good-looking, popular.
Oh, that's true.
And he was, like, the, what do you call it? The editor, head editor of the that school newspaper.
Right. And he might be Italian or Jewish or Spanish or...
Yeah, right.
And that they play with that too, that kind of, like, you know, the blending of identities. But you're right. The joke of that is all of our expectations and how we judge people based purely on their looks and not, you know, what they're actually capable of, the content of the character, if you will.
Right.
And I know there's nothing as insufferable as two white folk trying to show how I guess passionate they are. Or understanding or whatever, and I feel always kind of ridiculous when I do it. But they also talk about that in the show too,
right.
That like the tension between well-meaning white people that are kind of more or less on the right side, but still can't fully understand it, but try to say they do, and the people that are living it. I just think it's first of all and foremost, it's funny, and I also think it's pretty poignant and it feels real to me. And it's made and created by people who have lived the experience, so I imagine all that truth is in there.
Right, and the other interesting thing is that once Sam was confronted with, you know, her own actions, honestly, with the way she was sort of being a hypocrite about dating a white man and saying that you're a race traitor if you do, is that she came around almost, you know, immediately and understood right. that other perspective where, you know, some of the people... where the show is probably falling on deaf ears that need to listen is that it's so much easier when you're in a one down, two down position to immediately accept other people's perspectives
right.
where it's just so hard to get through to people who just have the horse blinders on.
I understand. And I, as a person,
and what do you do to open someone up to that without, you know, insulting them or making them feel bad?
I think,
or guilty.
I think it's really, I mean, there's a lot, cause I think it's important for, you know, I guess, like, I'm not a perfect feminist, but what I try to do is take my experiences and I can, in a way that is non-hostile and non-threatened and non-angry and defensive, explain those perspectives to other people who just don't get it and refuse to. And they, you can tell that, like, they've had experiences with feminists that come off as shrill and defensive and mean-spirited and they feel attacked, and I'm able to kind of slip past those offenses and get to...
The easiest way to shut someone down is to attack them.
But that's it's almost impossible not to attack when someone is essentially dismissing the truth of your existence.
Right.
So I guess it's partly, you know, you have to have very... smart and engaged people getting those perspectives out. You have to have people that are receptive to it that then go and take that back to their communities and be like, look, we do have a problem. You can't dismiss me because I am you, and I'm going to use your own language and your own experiences and experiences of, like, yes, it's really, like, I remember how hard and painful it is to deal with your own part in why society is fucked up. Like, you're like the fact that yeah you didn't ask for the different privileges that you have, but you've got them. And I don't know why it's so weird that privilege term has been like this loaded thing, because like everyone grew up with your mom and dad telling you to be thankful for the things that you have that like starving kids in Africa might not have, right, or communist kids in China not have. And you better take care of your shoes because there's a lot of kids out there. That is the concept of privilege. You have something that you don't even are aware of and are taking for granted that many other people don't have. And think of how much harder their life is. And here you are with that not hard thing, or that hard thing removed from your life, and you're acting ungrateful.
Right. And privilege isn't necessarily meaning that you have access to all things and all knowledge that other people don't. It's just you have easier access to those things.
Right.
Like this popular argument of men saying that, you know, they're not more privileged than women because they don't go to the bar and get drinks bought for them.
Right.
I mean, it's, yeah.
But that's, I mean, I think that's the interesting thing. Now, I don't know how, because that's the unfortunate thing is there's not like, you know, a documentary that's trying to do some kind of thing. Like, it's rare that like something like Blackfish comes wrong and like most, like 99% of people look at it and are horrified and like, this has got to stop, and you stop it.
Well, they're animals. It's cute. I can relate.
Well, and like, you know, no one. The thing about Blackfish is very few people, like, you might have gone and seen a SeaWorld performance, but you were ignorant of what you were doing, and you didn't personally go and, like, capture these whales and abuse them, and it's like, you know, now that you know the truth, of course. And I feel like that with race and gender and other constructs, we're taught those in school. Like, we're taught about the Civil War, and we're taught about civil rights, and we think we know, and we think that maybe, like, if you grew up in certain areas of the country, you might think that, like, those are things that were fought over a long time ago, and everything's all good now. You know, there's a black and an Indian kid and a white kid and an Asian kid on the cover of my social studies book, so everything's cool now.
Right.
And then you grow up and you realize
become
it's not.
Become president of the United States.
and you realize it's not, and you don't want to hear that, and you want to dismiss them as like, oh, well, these people, like, with all the advantages that they've been given, with all the blood that's been shed and all the strife, and they're still whining about things not being equal, what the fuck? Also, things haven't been so easy for me, and it's that kind of thing. And I certainly don't know how to, I don't have the solution for institutional racism in the world. And it's unfortunate that everything that is created in art and, you know, history and like documentaries, they're not created for everyone. Like a documentary pitched for someone who has done all of the foundational work and is ready for the next level to kind of uncover the next kind of fucked up thing. If a person just walks on the street and has not had that foundational understanding, they're going to be horrified and they're going to think, oh, this is a whole bunch of bullshit and these people hate America. And you see a lot of that to Dear White People. Like, Dear White People is not a primer.
It's not the answer or the solution at all.
It certainly can get you a lot of starting places to begin that inquiry, but you have to be pretty fucking tough and, you know, like stick it out. And, you know, you're going to hear a lot of things that make you feel uncomfortable and things that make you angry and things that make you sad about yourself and your situation. But that's it's better than sticking your head in the sand.
But overall, I think it's a good show.
Yeah.
And highly recommend. It's funny. It's cute. If nothing else, everyone is incredibly beautiful. So
yes,
go for that.
We can all agree on that. Shall we talk about... I want to talk about Handmaid's Tale. Because here's the thing about American Gods. I don't have much to say because the first episode washed over me like a tsunami.
And it was an orgy of sights and sounds.
I don't want to have to time code this for American Gods. Let's move to Handmaid's Tale, okay. Which is a television series based on the 1985 novel called The Handmaid's Tale by
Margaret Atwood,
a Canadian author. We've had four episodes. The first three episodes dropped on Hulu two Wednesdays ago. And then they're going to do one episode a week from here on out. I'll let you kind of explain and talk about this, and then we'll see where the conversation goes.
Yeah. If you are not familiar, it's a show about a dystopian future where women are basically enslaved, if not... Well, I think even the commander's wives are... conform to this new standard
for sure.
of living.
They might be in a better situation, but no one is happy.
Right. You have the,
a woman in this society.
Commander's wives. You have Martha's, which are like maids. They do all the cooking, cleaning, things like that. And then you have the handmaids, which have the sole purpose of bearing children in a world where children just aren't coming anymore.
Yeah.
Even a lot of the handmaids themselves are having trouble conceiving or bringing a baby to full term. If it comes full term, then one out of four babies live.
Mm-hmm.
So that's this woman's life. It's about the star is Elizabeth Moss as Offred,
mm-hmm. which you might remember as Peggy
from
Mad Men,
right? And it's a really hard show to watch, especially in this current political climate, I think, with women's rights, science, all kinds of things under fire. Throughout the show, you get sort of glimpses, because no one's allowed to read or educate themselves anymore. You get glimpses of what, the rest of the world is up to. I guess it's just certain parts of America that are under this
weird
Gilead regime.
Yeah, it's like a martial theocratic state.
Kind of a hyper strict Catholic, but if you're a doctor, a priest, a lesbian,
I wouldn't say the opposite. I think it's hyper Protestant. It's like a return to Puritanism. Because
right.
It's the priests that are outlawed, like a Catholic priest. We at one point we see a homosexual, a doctor, and a Catholic priest bodies hung up on the wall as for public display.
Right.
As enemies of the state.
Yeah. It doesn't seem, in the TV show, it doesn't seem like skin color is really a defining factor.
I heard that in the book that's more of a thing, that like all of the minorities have been rounded up and moved to kind of like the southern Midwest part of the United States to work in a slave camp.
Right.
They don't really do that in the show, though.
Right. So, it starts with them trying to, with the main character trying to escape to Canada, which is still a safe zone. Sometime in the series, the oranges show up at the supermarket, so you can see that they're still fighting throughout parts of America. And it's just difficult to watch, I think. So I can only imagine that it's... I guess a few years into, maybe 2 years, I'm going to guess, by the length of her hair.
Yeah, it's really hard, because we open up on the series with the woman that we find out who will be called Offred. And even her name is of Fred. Fred is the commander she's assigned to. They get stripped of their names, and they're named after their male, I guess, owners. And she's fleeing with her husband, trying to get across to the Canadian border, where there's safety and refuge from this craziness. And they're hunted down and captured. And her little 2-3-year-old girl is taken from her, mm-hmm. and she's put into the Handmaid's Order, the Red Center. And the other thing is, they throw you into this world with no real world building.
No.
Because they've said that this is Offred's second assignment, and we don't know what the significance of that second. Does that mean that she successfully carried a baby to term for another commander? Did she fail to conceive?
Mm-hmm.
There's another shoe dropped in his latest episode, where one of the doctors who was going after caring for Offred opined that it's the men who are largely sterile.
But the handmaids who are punished for it.
It's the women who are punished for being barren. It's all about their wombs opening or being closed or receiving or not receiving. And the men, all they have to do is thrust and grunt, and their job is done. Mm-hmm. It's also very... It's so weird how clinical this, like, the ritual is. Like, I forget what they call it. The ceremony. Where they have the handmaid lay between the legs of the commander's wife.
While she holds her wrists,
and the commander stands at the foot of the bed and kind of looks off, like almost like he's assuming a...
And I'm not sure if this is the experience for all the ceremonies, but he... Or this is how they do it.
That's particular. What I'm saying. Like, we don't have... I mean, we're just throwing this world. I'm just describing it to you. The commander assumes what looks like a test for... Like the doctor says, cough for me, please.
Right.
That kind of hands on the hips, head over to the side. And he...
Everyone fully clothed.
And all the household staff there to watch it.
Yeah.
And it's just really weird.
Right. And it's just so... casual for everyone but Offred, who's just trying to deal with this repeated trauma. You know, everyone shows up and they all comment on how they're late and people have things to do and their lives to get on with. And
it's like Downton Abbey if the dinner ceremony revolved around just a matter-of-fact rape of one of the servant girls.
Right.
Which actually Downton Abbey did do that in one season, didn't they? You know, Mrs. Bates.
Yeah.
Poor Anna. But it's just really, I don't know. It's like the difference between someone, it's like the reason that one scene in, Saving Private Ryan is so disturbing, where the German officer is killing the American and he's just like, shh, and like, you know, being very gentle and quiet about sticking a knife in his heart. Mm-hmm. That's like harder to take than like something in Fast and the Furious or like the Expendables, or people are just getting blown apart by bullets and stuff. The bloodlessness of it and the complete domination is what's really fucked up.
So yes, as the story moves forward, we get these scenes from her past life intermixed with, you know, when they first were inducted into the Red Center. She meets her friend Moira there, and
who's played by Samira Wiley.
Yes.
Which that's one of the reasons I think they were smart to do away with the racism part of it, because that, you know, if you had a story where anyone that's not white is off screen, you wouldn't have any room for a Samira Wiley to be awesome.
Right. But it's strange because I don't think there's any other people of color I've seen.
Not so far.
It's, you know, it kind of stood out to me when she dressed like an aunt. And she was the only black aunt I've ever seen. And mm-hmm. I feel like that would be... And she's also quite young.
Right.
So it seemed like that would be a red flag, but she just moved on to the train.
Yeah.
We don't know what happened to her.
Which, by the way, that performance that Peggy, Elizabeth Moss gave, where she is like telling Moira to leave her because she's been detained and things aren't going well with her eyes, and she's like, you know, thinking hopeful thoughts, and as soon as Moira commits, like her face of like, oh yay, I'm happy for you, turns to this like just all consuming anguish that now she's missed her opportunity. Yeah. And it's so good.
Right. And her daughter has been taken away from her. We see her walk past a school with some older children. So it seems like they took all of the children from before and are raising them up to be handmaids, Marthas, whatever they are.
Uh-huh.
Her husband seems to have gotten shot and killed, but we never see his body. So I'm wondering if that'll come back eventually.
Yeah, me too. I've been conditioned by the golden age of television to think that if someone's killed off screen, they're going to show up later on. Now, I've been burnt by that a lot, but more often than not, it does pay off.
Right. I mean, it's just like the things that are most haunting and affecting are the things you don't see.
Right. And
the woman who occupied the house before Offred scratched some Latin into the closet.
Right.
Like, you don't have to see what happened to her to get the impact and the, you know, feelings that it brought forward into Offred and us as the audience.
Yeah, and like there's even some of this. It's so interesting to see, because one of the things that happens is the commander, contrary to everything that we've been taught, invites Offred to his parlor late at night.
Which is something that you don't do.
Well, yeah, and no one else is aware in the house, and he invites her to play Scrabble, which has her admit that she can read and she is in, you know, and she lets him win and does all these other things. But she's the other thing is this makes the rare good use of internal narration where we hear Offred's thoughts. And as she's thinking, like calculating things, and she's also, you know, this is the same episode that she found the scratching on the wall that is in Latin. Don't let the bastards get you down.
Grind you down.
Oh, grind you down.
Yeah.
She's thinking, like, as she's playing Scrabble with the commander, it's like, did you, you know, this other, the other Offred, did you do this? Did you, how did you mess this up? Did you just fail to bear a child? Did you say something wrong? Did you beat him? What caused this mask of, you know, camaraderie and compassion to fall away and you be driven out? And, I mean, usually internal monologues are kind of cheesy. It's a rare thing that can pull them off. I feel like this does it pretty well.
Right. Not sure what the show would be like if we didn't get a glimpse inside of her head. But, you know, she's doing some really powerful acting with just one bone in her neck.
Yeah. Yeah. Because she's just so taut, right?
Yeah.
And she's scared to death. Like, you have to. And it's interesting because there's... they're paired up. Anytime the handmaids leave the house, they have to leave in pairs. So
everyone's each other's spy.
Everyone's each other's spy. And there's this one of the interesting things in the first episode is how much Offred despises, is it Ovglin?
Yeah.
Her assignment, who's played by Alexis Bledel, which you might know as the youngest of the Gilmore Girls.
Right.
And she hates her because they, you know, she's just so pious. Because
she's doing the same thing she's doing.
And but she realizes that, you know, in the second episode that she's just doing what she's doing, which is saying what you're supposed to say because you can't tell who can be trusted.
Right.
They eventually kind of let their hair down and, you know, befriend each other. And then you find out that Ovglin is actually a lesbian. And then she's actually... if you know where this is going, you do. And if you're, I don't want to spoil it too much for you, but
she trusted one too many people,
but she's also our glimpse into a larger world because she proclaims that she's a member of the resistance, which is some kind of underground resistance. And she informs of Offred that there's actually a spy inside her household. One of the terrifying eyes, the secret kind of Stasi secret service, of the society. And I remember when I was, before I'd watched this, I was listening to Andy and Chris talk on the Ringer, the Watch podcast, and they're like, oh man, we really had no idea Alexis Bledel could be this good. And I've seen her in a lot of things. I love Gilmore Girls. I thought she was really bad in Mad Men and almost everything else I've seen her in. So I was skeptical because I feel like she's got her lane and she just can't get out of it. But she is really good. Did you think she was good?
Yeah, I think everyone's bringing something really powerful to the table. I'm simultaneously reading the book as well as watching the show. I'm sort of reading them side by side. When I read up to a part where we're at in the show, I'll put it down for a while.
What's that experience like? What's the book compared to the show?
The book is a lot more dry.
Okay.
It doesn't have the sort of colorful internal dialogue that Offred in the show has, you know, such as when Nick says, are you off to the market? And she makes a quip about, no, I'm going to go throw some back in her head. And she just says, blessed be the fruit, something like that.
So we don't have that kind of, you know, pithy modern woman dialogue inside her head?
We don't. It's just a lot of, you know, straightforward factual telling about how things are now, and, you know, her looking back on her previous life, and you know, and it's much more sad but also very dry, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. She, you know, kinda describes
like the Leftovers novel versus the Leftovers TV show.
Right. She describes, you know, things that she did before, her life before, in a sort of way that makes you think that maybe it's starting to get to her head. Maybe she does feel guilty that, you know, she...
That's a well-known psychological phenomenon.
Right. I don't want to give anything away in the book, but, you know, just sort of there's a term for that. Not Stockholm syndrome, but something more like that, where you start to identify with your captor. I guess that's exactly Stockholm syndrome. But she's still got this resilient part of her that's still resisting being captured. You know, the scratching of don't let the bastards grind you down helps a lot. They also changed the characters quite a bit. Like you said, the book was written in 1987.
85.
It's very white, which mm-hmm. I guess you can identify with if you were in 1987. Mm-hmm. The commander and his wife, most of the commanders and their wives are much older. They aged them down and made them much more beautiful in the show.
That's a very Hollywood thing to do, sure.
Exactly.
So is there a little bit of, like, with the commander and the commander's wife being much older, I mean, is that a much...
So it may, in the book...
A very stronger allusion to the Bible where, like, Abraham and Sarah have no business having children. They're, like, in their 90s.
Right. So
is it just biologically impossible for these kids to have, or these people to have children and they're...
Exactly. So in the Rent Center, they tell us that it's because of, you know, radioactive waste and, mm-hmm. you know, the way that the world started to run, a lot of climate change deniers
right.
that made it physically impossible for you to not have children anymore. Where in the book, it makes it seem more like it's just the older people they put in charge need children to continue. So they're harvesting the young, fertile women.
Huh.
But again, halfway through the book, I'll figure it out.
Yeah, because it's interesting because there's this political thought that the young people are going to be our savior if you're a liberal progressive, that like young people don't believe in racism, young people don't believe in sexism. And what I've seen as I get older is that there's a fresh crop of racist and sexist people born every generation.
Right.
It's not that the young people monolithically agree to this or that they're not going to then be moderated as they start to have... Like, maybe the needle of progress is swinging towards, you know, the right way consistently, but I'm not so sure anymore. I'm not so sure that if we don't let our guard down and we let slip standards of education and public discourse that... A whole generation of racist, sexist fucks will not rise up and take their place.
I think we just come up, each generation comes up with new prejudices and new ways to put each other down because that's just kind of the human experience. And I'm not justifying it, but we'll find new ways to hate each other. We always do.
I'm saying that we rediscover old ways because Margaret Atwood, maybe from what, and this, I haven't read the books, I'm just going from your judgment. It almost sounds like that. Maybe her fear was the old folks, instead of just dying off, would find other ways to keep perpetuating their species. What I'm saying is that I don't know that that's necessary because the same societal pressures that form them are history is cyclical. And, you know, like Russ Cole says, time is a flat circle. maybe we're doomed to repeat all these problems because we take our eye off the ball.
That's true. And it's... particularly affecting for me because, well, Elizabeth Moss is just absolutely killing it in this role, but it's very easy. I know we talked a lot about, you know, social issues with the Dear White People, but it's just very difficult and exhausting to be anyone who's in a minority position.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only got a very small fraction of that
right.
to watch this kind of thing happen with the current president we have.
Right.
And I know...
Because you have a man to protect you.
And I know that
you're no longer unescorted out in the streets to be taken advantage of.
There's no way that they, you know, wrote the show and shot everything in December.
Right.
So the fact that they did this last year, or maybe the year before when they started to come up with this idea, and the fact that it's dropping now is just very affecting. So if you're watching it, just be prepared for that.
It's also funny because I forced myself to read conservative sites like Red State mm-hmm. To kind of like, you know, to not to do my part to like
introduce,
you know,
other perspectives into
just,
your life.
Just not keep, let myself bubble up because there's bubbles on both sides. There's liberal bubbles, conservative bubbles. It's arguable that the people accusing the liberals of living in bubbles on the coast are not aware of the fact that they're in a bubble that most of the Western world is in another bubble. It's not just the coast of America. It's Australia. It's Canada. It's the UK. It's France. It's Germany. It's like everybody but you guys. They're in this other bubble. But I read an article where Red State was like, oh, yes, the liberals are all on a Twitter about, The Handmaid's Tale and, you know, how concerned they are about the way America's going. And what they don't understand is the ultimate defense against The Handmaid's Tale is small government. And I'm like, okay, so my choice is enslaving women or access to socialized medicine. Like, really? I can't have my cake and eat it too. I can't have you know, a robust government that can take care of, you know, public good and also not have it run amok and enslave women and minorities. Like, I kind of think we can do both.
Right. And I'm
not saying. But it's those episodes where they just completely discount, like they don't want to, like, I mean, to me, a retort to The Handmaid's Tale would be to identify how conservative ideology is not in opposition to any of the ideals espoused in that.
Right.
Like, you know, it's not to be like, well, you just don't, of course we'll want to do that, but you put small government in place and we won't be able to. Like, what the fuck? I can't believe I'm reading this.
I don't think anyone believes that this is the way the country's headed. And if you do, then
I just want to say,
that's the wrong kind of thinking.
It does seem like there is and I got myself embroiled into it as well, there's this discussion of, can this happen here? And I don't think cautionary tales, like, that's their prime... It's not their prime purpose is to convince you that it can or can't and to scare you, frighten you. It's another way to open up a dialogue or to empower people to take action, regardless of whether it gets this bad.
Right. You know? And I think it's very, you know, I think what they're trying to say here mostly is that it's baby steps. You know, they kind of are revealing this backstory. It's, you know, one day it's one small thing and then the next day it's another small thing. And those things build up into one future that we don't want. It doesn't benefit anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder if they'll continue, because the one thing, I guess, that the reason I get kind of embroiled, because I do spend a lot of time as I'm watching it thinking, oh, surely to God, somebody would do something at this stage. It's like, it doesn't seem like they've done a very good job of showing that slow frog boil. It's literally like a coffee barista called them whores, and then their jobs are taken away, and that same day their bank accounts are confiscated
and transferred over to the next male kin.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like, there wasn't, like, what is the legislate? Like, there's got to have been a lot of other, or, you know, maybe it's just a violent. And that's part of just being dropped in the world, and I hope that they maybe build that out, because it. I don't know. We're talking about, you know, how not all pieces of art can be for everybody, but I'm always looking for ways that it can be a little bit more inclusive to different perspectives, or a little bit more armored towards being dismissed by the people that should watch it. And I think that's one of the ways that, like, if you could convincingly show that you could get from, you know, 2017 to this kind of puritanical dystopia, that would be helpful. It'd be a lot more people would be on the conversation, because what I've seen on the internet is the people that are really having meaningful conversations about this are the people, are the choir.
Right.
Now, the choir needs to be energized, and the choir needs to know what its rights are, and needs to stand up to things, and needs to not be asleep at the switch and all those other things. But it also seems like it would be beneficial if maybe more people were swayed by it or moved by it.
Right. So all we can do is continue to create these pieces of art. Handmaid's Tale, Dear White People, the 13th on Netflix, for fuck's sake, go watch it.
Right.
And just try to not let history repeat itself.
That would be nice. That would be nice. Shall we talk about American Gods?
Because
it looks amazing. I got from American Gods that there is Ian McShane is a Norse god, and Pablo Schreiber is a very large bellicose leprechaun.
They're all types of gods, so some sort of leprechaun.
There was a buffalo that was on fire, and this all swirls around the leading man. Who is, I'm closing my eyes and trying to remember what he looks like, and I keep on coming up with a guy who's from Prison Break. Like, it's just the default setting for dude. It's just a glowering stubble ridden, shaved head,
ex-con,
bristling muscles.
So we've seen exactly one episode of this show.
Yes.
And it's, like I said earlier, it's just a lot of lights, colors, sounds. It's insane. It's stars, so that'll set your barometer, I think.
It looks great, and it's well acted, and it's got really crackling dialogue and situations. It's just, I don't know what to make of it yet.
Right, and it's got such a good pedigree already that I'm in for everyone involved, except, well, for the star. I haven't seen him in anything.
Would you like to talk about the pedigree? Do you know?
Yes. It's got, well, you said Pablo Schreiber,
uh-huh.
Ian McShane from Deadwood. It's got Emily Browning, who's been in a lot of things, including Sucker Punch, which you
gotcha.
Love.
Gotcha. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, I do. I'm number one fan.
It's
Zack Snyder can do no wrong.
Kristen Chenoweth.
Mm-hmm.
It's got Crispin Glover.
No kidding.
Yeah.
He hasn't shown up yet.
No, he hasn't.
It's from the pedigree I was talking about, it was based on a book by Neil Gaiman.
Oh, Neil Gaiman, yeah.
Who I'm not a huge fan. I mean, I'm not a huge fan, not because I hate him. It's just I'm very unfamiliar with his work. So,
right.
But I know the people that are like really excited about this kind of.
Right. I have a few books on it of his on my shelf right now, but I haven't read this particular one.
Uh-huh.
So, and I'm not going to. Maybe after
same
the
here.
Series
people
ends.
Ask me if I'm going to, and I'm like, I'm going to wait until it's over because
right.
my experience is. It's much easier to go from a fan of the adaptation to a fan of the original work.
Right.
It seems like people just get bitter and pissed about the original work getting adapted to anything.
Right. And the reason I even started reading The Handmaid's Tale is because this show is one of the first I can think of in a long time where I just can't wait until next week. Like if you offered me the next episode of The Handmaid's Tale, I would give you a blank check.
Uh-huh.
So that's just my way of getting more in my life. But
my experience with my relationship with you is when if we're watching something that's like super high concept, like 30 minutes in, I'll be like, man, where is this going? And I look over and you're on your phone on Wikipedia reading the plot synopsis. Because you just can't. You want to know.
Well, I mean, for things that I don't plan on watching twice, but I want to understand as it's going through the first time, and so I don't miss anything, I do that.
So it's kind of
I just
like
to enrich my experience and get all angles.
It's a second screen experience.
Exactly. The Handmaid's Tale, I haven't read ahead, and I'm not going to. It's just one of those things where it's
we'll see if
what do you call it? I'm edging myself.
I wonder what the aunts would say about that. You get your clitoris cut off for sure.
But we're talking about American Gods. We're gonna keep watching it, and we're gonna keep Bald Move TVing it.
Uh-huh.
Correct.
Yeah, I think about every 2 weeks when we get two new episodes of American Gods and Handmaid's Tale, we'll come back and talk about it. And then we also might, when we get finished wrapping up Dear White People, we might get our overall thoughts on that.
And I also want to talk about Sense8, which is coming back on Friday.
Okay.
And
you might be the only... Can you do a solo podcast? Because I haven't seen the first season.
I'm just going to talk about it on Bald Move TV with you.
Okay,
I'll just
cool.
talk at you.
That's a novel experience, because usually I'm the talkie or I'm the talker and Jim's the talk added, and it's rare that sometimes he goes on about the reality show he's watching and I'm like, what?
I mean, he's watching Sense8. I would love to talk
that's
to him
true.
About
maybe
it.
Maybe you guys can do a podcast.
Yeah, I don't know. Future plans.
Yeah. The other thing is we've got I don't want to promise that yet.
No. Don't do that.
We might.
We've got other things in the works.
We've got other things bubbling in the cauldron.
Now we're edging the audience.
Don't finish yourselves. So that's it. So I want to kind of bring back, because I think that there is enough meat to these conversations, and these are going to be ones we're having regularly enough that I want to kind of bring back the Young Pope feedback loop. That we actually had some feedback in our episode.
Oh, right.
So if you want to send email about Handmaid's Tale or American Gods or Dear White People or whatever, you want to fight with us, you want to praise us, you want to discuss with us, do it at TV.
You
want to
give us your perspective.
TV@baldmove.com. And as always, I can't promise to read them all, but read them all on air. I will read them all. But we'll be looking for perspectives to talk about.
And we will promise to stay woke.
Stay woke? Yeah. We should maybe play the Childish Gambino out.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Seconded and motion hold. So we will see you in about 2 weeks for the next two episodes of American Gods and Handmaid's Tale. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Cecily.
See ya.